I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the latest Royal Automobile Club podcast in association with Motorsport Magazine. My name's Simon Aaron, I'm features editor of Motorsport, and I'm delighted to be joined today by my colleague Samarth Kanal. Morning, Samarth. And also three times Speedway world champion Ty Woffenden, the only man to have won it three times, I believe. Ty, a very warm welcome to the Royal Automobile Club.
Thanks, mate. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Just cruising around and checking out the building and all the history that's here. It's an amazing place.
The reason you're here is for a lunch to receive the Torrens Trophy, which has previously been awarded to a number of motorcycle racing greats: Jonathan Ray, Cal Crutchlow, John McGuinness. It's not bad company to be in, is it?
It is. I don't really know Cal personally. I know one of my friends, Sam Lowe's, hangs out with him a little bit on the MotoGP course, but Johnny and Mr. McGuinness I know quite well. So it's great people to be have my name up there with, and I know them personally as well. So it's pretty cool.
Let's talk about your own career. Your background is slightly unusual in that you were born in Scunthorpe and you grew up in Perth, Western Australia. That's not a common combination. Your background, your father Rob sadly passed away a few years ago, I know, but he was a highly respected speedway rider. So he took the family over to Western Australia. For you, was the speedway thing, was it just something that happened when you were 3 or 4 years old, which is often what happens to the progeny of bike racers?
I've been on there's videos and pictures of me on a bike from when I was like before I could walk. So that was obviously when we was in the UK. Then we went out to Australia, ended up getting like a KX60, used to race motocross, just as more of a hobby to do on the weekend. And then when I was 12, we went to our friend's house who had a track in his garden, and we was racing that track. And when we was prepping the bikes on the Saturday night, I saw a Speedway bike tucked away in the corner, and I wanted to have a go on that. And my dad goes, like, I never knew that my dad raced at that point. So my dad was like, oh, like, we can't really afford to have both bikes. You'd have to sell your motocross bike and if you want to try that. So I was like, yeah, sweet. So I sold the motocross bike and got a Speedway bike, and that was the start of it. Just went to the local track and did a practice day. And a week later, after we got the bike, there was one of the rounds of the Australian Under-16 Championship, and they were short a couple of riders. So they said, you know, if you can do a start, then we'll put you in the event. So the first start, like, I stalled it, and then the second one I stalled it, third one I was away, and they was like, yeah, sweet, you're in. So that was my first event when I was, that would have been 2002, I would say.
You see, you weren't aware growing up that your father had been a Speedway rider.
No.
And how the hell did he keep that quiet? Was it a deliberate effort on his part to kind of shield you from the sport?
It just never got spoke about. I didn't even like when I was racing the 125s and the junior speedway in Australia, I never really knew that, like, what he did. Like, I just knew him as like a guy that sold cars because he had a car yard. So like, that was my dad's job. Never knew any of the motorcycling background. So I didn't actually realize until we came to Europe, and like a first year in Europe, and everyone's like, oh, you know, you just like your dad and you like got the same style as him. And I was like, what do you mean? And they was like, oh yeah, he used to race. And I was like, my dad used to race. And then I started asking questions and they started explaining. So it was a strange one.
And what for you was the particular appeal of Speedway? I mean, the Grand Prix bikes have got 500 brake horsepower, something like that?
No, they're 500cc.
500cc, sorry.
Yeah, so they've got like 77 horsepower.
Oh, sorry, but sorry, I do apologise. Yeah.
The bike weighs 77 kilograms, so it's like 1 kilogram per horse. So the power to weight ratio is quite extraordinary. It's noted that they accelerate faster than a Formula One, so they're pretty quick. but it's just an exciting sport. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's one of the only sports you can sit there and watch the whole race, like one of the motorcycling sports or racing sports in general. You know, you can sit in the grandstand, watch every race all night, which I think is a plus when you want to go. Because if I go to watch an event, I always watch it from home, not a speedway event, like a other motorsporting event, because I get to see the whole race. Like, I wouldn't want to fly to Valencia to watch MotoGP, and you go all that way to watch them come past you once and go around the corner. So that's what makes speedway so exciting, and that's why so many people love it.
And it is, I mean, it's popular in this country. I think 50,000 people watch the British Grand Prix in this country.
Yeah.
Yet it's not the kind of sport that gets mainstream news coverage in the same way as MotoGP would, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
And, I mean, do you get recognized in the street and stuff when you're walking around? Do people go, oh, that's Ty Woffenden? Or do you feel like speedway needs a lot more coverage as well?
Of course it needs more coverage. Like, it's classed as a minority sport. So when you come to, like, events like BBC Sports Personality, you know, speedway is always overlooked. You know, I think this year just gone, there wasn't actually that many British athletes that had achieved anything. For instance, like the England football team, they didn't achieve anything, yet they was up there. I've won my third world title and there wasn't a mention. So there's little things like that, whereas if it was more in the mainstream, then them kind of things would arise more. But I guess on the flip side, like, I don't want to be no like Lewis Hamilton where I can't go to the shop. Like, I can go to the shop now and a couple of people, like if I go to Asda or something or Tesco, someone will stop me, a couple of people, two or three people max. Three people max, two people pretty much every time I go. And I'll sit down and have a couple of minutes conversation with them, and they'll ask, you know, what are you doing here? Like, just at like local food stores. And, you know, that's kind of nice. I can deal with that.
And how easy is it? I mean, I know you got there from a very young age, but how easy is it to get into speedway if you're a young rider trying to, you know, I know motocross, there's a lot going on, but speedway seems like a very dangerous physical sport. It looks to me like a rodeo. You know, you're kind of trying to hang on to the bull, or actually dodge the bull in a way as well. And rodeo's horses.
It's funny you say that, because we were sat having a coffee this morning. One of the guys that I was with, he goes, it's like speedway is like the gladiators and their chariots. We're like the modern day of them. Like, if they was living in this day and age, they'd ride a speedway bike. That's what he said earlier. And I thought that was quite a good like way of looking at it. But They're a real simple bike. They're simple, they're fast, and they're exciting. And when you ride them, you get this like thrill, this big buzz of adrenaline. And the level that I'm at now, I've become like one with the bike. So for me, it's like so easy to ride a bike. But for someone getting started, yes, it is a little bit dangerous, a little bit hard. But then, you know, it's dangerous doing everything. You know, there's always the risk factor of doing any motorsport.
Have you tried an ice speedway bike? Because that always struck me as being particularly loopy.
Well, I hate the cold. So I haven't even given it a second thought. I know what the sport is. I actually met one of the guy that won the world championship last year at the FIM Awards. We sat on the same table, Russian dude, and he was like showing me, he couldn't speak any English, but he was showing me some videos of like what he's been doing. And I was like, dude, that looks so fun, but man, that must be so cold.
Well, it's so cold, and also if you get hit by another bike, that's one thing, but another bike with spikes, spikes in the tyres.
Become a bit of a pincushion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I always go back to Australia in the off-season where it's warm and the sun's shining. That's my thing.
So whereabouts, are you based in the UK now when you're in Europe?
Yeah, so we live in between Nottingham and Derby. We've got like a 6-minute drive from East Midlands Airport, which is nice because I get all my connections from there, or Birmingham. So it's really good. As far as that's concerned, my wife's from Nottingham, so it's just across the M1. And then we go back to Australia for the off season. So Faye has to do 6 months a year now in Australia, so she'll be
it's
out there.
It's no hardship, is it?
We just put in for a permanent residency, and obviously my daughter's got her passport through by descent, so through me. And then just going through the process of getting all Faye's stuff sorted, so she's about 7 years away from receiving an Australian passport.
When I was growing up as a kid, speedway was on telly quite a bit. ITV, Dave Lanning doing the commentary, Peter Collins from Bellevue Aces, Barry Briggs, Ivan Major were kind of the big names, and I used to watch it a lot. And it was accessible in your living room during the highlights packages during the week. It was great, but it did seem to drift a bit. I don't know when 1990s. Have you any idea why the popularity did diminish a little bit?
I'm not really sure. Like, as far as the sport's concerned, it's raw, it's fast, it's exciting. So
exactly,
there's no reason why that should have happened. When you go to speedway events now, you do see a lot of older people at the events. There's not really, you know, there's not that many like 15 to 20 year olds. Where an event like that, where it's busy and they're serving beer and all that sort of thing, you want it to be full of them sort of people, because they're your next generation of,
well, also, but also the riders of that generation as well.
Yeah, for sure. So I don't know, I think it's probably in the UK, I think it's more a lack of not having a barrier working for Speedway that knows 100% this is what we need to do to make it successful. Instead, you've got maybe a couple of people that are trying to do it, but they're a little bit out of their depth and they don't really know the process to get that sport great again. But, you know, from a rider's point of view, that's not my job. I've given my thoughts on how I think the sport can move forward over various press releases over the last, well, since 2013, which always seems to fall on deaf ears. So I'll just keep riding my bike and doing my thing.
And you've been also quite vocal about wanting far more speedway titles than you already have. You've got three now. How many are you actually aiming for? I've seen various numbers get thrown around, but really, how many do you think you can feasibly get?
I can feasibly get whatever I want to get, like as long as I ride. Like, I genuinely believe that when I bring my A game and I'm fit and ready and 100%, I'll win the world title. Because for me to win the world title, I just need to like be fit and healthy, and I'll win. When I'm not fit and healthy, I still get on the podium at the end of the year. So like, my years at our class is really bad. It's like 14, 16, 17 in miles was really bad, and I can still get on the podium at the end of the year. So when I put my mind to it, I can achieve it. So I put my mind to it. We did some stuff with some fans at the start of last year, and I was sat in a room and I said to all of them, I'm going to win the world title this year. And they were like, a few of them laughed and a few of them was like, oh, he's a bit arrogant, like whatever. But I knew the hard work that I put in pre-season. So, and I know that if I bring my A game, I'll win the world title. So I put in the hard work in pre-season. I got to the start of the season. I was like, I'm ready. Like, I'm going to win. And then I backed it up and I won. And then all winter, all I've done is focus on this year to go back to back. There's only a select handful of riders that have gone back to back. And I want to be one of them riders. And the answer to your question is, I want to win 7 world titles. The most that's ever been won is 6. So I want to be the greatest of all time. So that means winning 7. And then on that 7th world title, I'll stand on the podium and retire there and then.
I've seen few sports persons be that confident about winning anything. That is genuinely amazing. And of course, I mean, who am I to say that you can't do it? But that is genuinely amazing. But when can you feasibly keep going? I mean, how long can you keep going now? You're nearing 30-ish.
Greg Hancock, an American rider, he's still riding now, and God, he's a fossil. Like, I'm good friends with him. He's not a fossil. He's
a fossil to you is probably about 31, 32 or something. Yeah. He's not that old.
He's experienced. Yeah. This is a mutual agreement we have between each other.
An experienced fossil.
I won't say he's old, and I have to say he's experienced, and we always have a little joke about it. But yeah, Greg, I don't want to say his age because I don't want to disrespect him. But he's one of the oldest riders in the field, and he's still competitive. So as long as the desire's there and the want and the will to succeed, and I can keep going back to Australia and hurting myself physically to be prepared for the new season, then I'll keep going.
You've got quite a cosmopolitan existence at the moment. I mean, you've 6 months of the year based in the UK, 6 in Australia, and the teams you're riding for are based in Sweden and Poland. How does that work?
So I'm like a FIFO worker. So I just fly in, fly out. I have a base in Poland and a base in Sweden, and obviously live in England when we're here, and then just jump on a plane, fly into Poland, race, fly back. So it's quite straightforward. I race Poland every Sunday, Sweden every Tuesday, from April to the end of October, and the Grand Prix are pretty much every fortnight with a little break in the middle of the season. So I normally fly to Poland on Friday night or Saturday morning, practice Saturday, race Sunday, fly to Sweden Monday, race Sweden Tuesday, fly back Wednesday.
I really want to see your air miles account, by the way.
It's no good because we always fly with them budget airlines where you get
nothing.
when you're paying, if you book your tickets in advance, like a flight to Sweden, I'm getting like £20 return. Like, I don't even know how they can afford to run at £20 return, but that's what the flights are. So, but you have to be a little bit organized and book everything in advance.
So from a practical point of view, what's the reason for riding with Swedish and Polish teams rather than, say, a British team and a European team?
So the level that I'm at in the world, obviously world championship level, you want to be performing at that level all the time. So when we race in Poland, that's the hardest league in the world, closely followed by Sweden. Some years Sweden seems harder than Poland, but then some years Poland seems harder. So they're like on a level playing field. You know, you look at the teams and you're like, man, like you can't look it through the team and find one weak rider. They're normally like all strong. So, you know, to race at that top level, you need to be performing against them top athletes on a daily basis to keep that level of intensity there for when you get to the World Championship.
And how far behind that level is Britain at the moment?
I think there might be one World Championship rider racing in the UK at the moment, Jason Doyle, but don't quote me on that. But I don't know anyone else that was. Freddie Lindgren was, Chris Holder was, but I don't think Chris is racing in England this year. Freddie's not racing in England this year. So there's, there's more and more people, more and more top riders dropping out to focus on Poland and Sweden.
Let's go through a little bit of the technicalities of a speedway bike. A tyre, one race, two races, an engine, a weekend, a meeting. How often do you have to change those things?
So an engine I'm doing 15 minutes on, which essentially is five races. If we practice, then I'll do 20 minutes on it, because practice is a little bit more like lower intensity and we'll be trying different things. So sometimes I might go out and do two laps rather than four. So we do a little bit more in practice. But like I can go to Poland and wear out four engines like straight away. And then, you know, you go for one day practice in Poland and you send all your engines for a service. So luckily my tuner is Polish. So that's not too much of an issue.
And how long does an engine change take?
An engine change, I reckon my boys do it in about 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes or something. So,
to the car world, that is completely alien.
So I'm actually going to call him and find out, because I'm sure that question will come up later. But I want to know the exact number. But it's fast. A speedway bike's so simple. Like you have there's five bolts holding the engine in, a Jubilee clip holding the carburetor on. So you take your carburetor off under your engine bolts, essentially just pop your exhaust off and pull it out the way, and you can drop the whole engine out. So it's yeah, it's more the little like cable ties on the little bits, like the oil overflow and all your little like tricky bits that take that little bit more time. But as far as unbolting the engine and dropping it down, it's so easy.
So reliability's never been an issue in this world, because once again, when I see,
we're trying to win a world title this year.
No, you just said you want to win seven, but that's as again, what I'm getting back to how confident you are. It's because you can be sure that it's not going to be like a backmarker F1 car where
the team that I've employed, they're 100%. Like the bikes, there's a guy called Lee Adams who retired, got injured, paralyzed. He's now doing stuff with kids in Australia. And when we was at the Australian Grand Prix, he'd come down with the kids and he'd like stop at my bikes and he'd go, kids, if you want to be world champion, this is what your bikes need to look like. And he says it every year he comes past, says how nice the bikes look, how like well presented we are, how the team is. He just says we stand out from the rest, which is nice coming from him, because he was a world-class rider for a long time. And it's nice that he can see that. And he's telling all the kids, the future Australian kids, you know, this is what you need your stuff to look like. Going back to your question, so the engine 15 minutes, the tire, because we have no brakes, the wheel's reversible. So you can like pop the wheel out, undo the sprocket, put it on the other side, bolt it back on and spin it around and slide it in. So we do like one race, so a minute per edge. So you do like one race on one edge, come in, flip the tire, one race on the next edge, next wheel. So we have like five or six wheels fitted in Parc Fermé, ready to rock and roll for a Grand Prix. And we just put a new edge on every race.
And you have one gear on these bikes, so...
Yeah, they're just set in gear, so you have to like bump start it. There's no like... And you hold the clutch in and bump start it. And then
so in terms
away.
Of setup, what do you do to, you know, I know what we can do with a car. There's camera angles, there's suspension setup and all this, but what is there on a speedway bike to set up?
So we have no rear suspension, so that we've got no suspension issues. The front suspension's leading link forks, which is like 1930s. So we have Ohlins on the front for the damper, and the rebound is essentially like two rubbers, because that's how the forks work. So that's like taken a heap of stuff away from what we have to focus on, because as you know, with like cars or MotoGP, suspension's huge. So getting rid of that's perfect because we don't need that. And then we got like wheelbase, so front and back, sprockets, so keep taking teeth off. If the wheel's spinning too much and you're not getting any traction, just keep dropping sprockets off. But then you can go too far and then the engine will be like lazy and sluggish, so you might want to go back up one, and then retard the ignition or advance the ignition, or go bigger on the jet, smaller on the jet, depending on the air density. So we have like little weather stations in and we're checking what's going on and we're logging everything. So we know that, you know, in the winter we need to run a little bit bigger jet, in the summer we need to run a smaller jet to achieve the same thing, but it all depends on what the pressure's doing. So yes, does get technical.
Okay, yeah, no, I actually didn't expect that level of technicality.
And then,
I was getting scientific.
And then, yeah, then we start to look at, once, now the level that I'm at, they're just like simple things. So like when you first start, you learn how to change a jet and ignition and wheelbase and sprocket. So now we're looking at like more stuff. So over the last probably year and a half, I've developed my own rear part of the chassis to get more traction, and we're now working on something that's going to have better starts. We've got really good traction coming into the corner, but there's a little bit of traction to be gained coming out of the corner. So we're looking at like 1% here and there, just trying to get some more marginal gains. And, you know, you find 10 1% and you're 10% better off. So, but to find 10 1% at the level that we're at is very hard, but it's not impossible.
The leading Formula One teams spend something like $350, $400 million per season. What's the cost of a full Speedway Grand Prix season, budget, in terms of budget?
I haven't broke it down into a Speedway Grand Prix season, but a full like a full season with Sweden, Poland and the Grand Prix is £350,000.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That's what it cost me to run. Yeah. So, and whereas like F1, MotoGP and all that, they all are a team that employ a driver. So I'm the team. So I employ the guys, I pay for all the costs, I have all the income, I fix all the sponsorship. So it works a little bit different, but at least that way I'm in full control of everything that's going on. And like you said before, there's no like back markers or, you know, like we haven't got a good enough engine, because it's me that organises that. So I just make sure that I want to be successful, so I make sure I'm in that right area with all the right gear.
And the budget comes partly from sponsors, as you say, but some of it prize money as well?
Or? Yeah, so yeah. I get paid on how I perform in Poland, so per point. Same in Sweden. And then the World Championships is on placing, and then there's sponsorship income from advertising.
Without wishing to give away any secrets, I mean, is there just a sort of basic set of rules about speedway riding technique? I mean, I have to confess to my shame, I've never watched them live, I've never watched them on telly, but I think they're wonderful things to behold. What is the basic just kind of trick to riding a speedway bike and maintaining your momentum and not falling off?
Well, I guess the thing that you learn when you first start is to, you got like 1 foot pegs back and really low, and the left side's high and quite like far forward. So one good technique is to keep your foot on the left foot peg when you're going down the straight, and you apply a little bit of pressure and it straightens the bike up and gets the bike to hook up. And then I remember to learn how to slide it, I had to stand on my right foot peg and get my body weight really far forward. And that was just to get the weight off the back end and obviously let it drift a little bit more. So, and then as the years go on, you know, you start to understand and learn and figure out how the bike works. Then you start changing things on the bike to change your body position. And now a Speedway bike's got wheel spin. So we've got so much wheel spin and all we're doing is constantly detuning to try and stop the wheel from spinning and have good traction so we can go fast. So all them little 1% is to actually get the bike to hook up, still carry the power, but hook up and go forward. So.
And what's your physical preparation like? Because it obviously it seems like a physically intense sport, but you weigh, this is one of the few motorsport, actually probably the only motorsport where you could weigh less than the machine that you're riding,
yeah,
right?
So I'm 66.7 and the bike's 77.
I mean, so your weight must make a huge, huge difference here. So what's your pre-season preparation like? Is there an off-season for you as well? I mean,
yeah, I have about like three weeks to a month rest.
Right.
And then like recharge my batteries and then it's like back into the training. So I actually was training for some triathlons this year. So that was just a target that I set myself. I joined up for Busselton Ironman on the 1st of December, full distance.
Wow.
So I always set myself these like stupid little challenges. Like the other year I wanted to backflip a motocross bike, so I did that. Then like this year I wanted to race my friend's sprint car in Australia. They have the sprint cars with the big wings on.
Nice.
So I raced that, I finished second in that. Like that was pretty cool. But yeah, like I do a lot of swimming, running, cycling, strength work, resistance training. And then as the winter starts, then it's a lot more endurance stuff. And then as we get closer to the season, it's a lot more high intensity stuff.
And what's your resting heart rate at now?
My resting heart rate?
Yeah, must, because it's going to put me to shame.
It's only going to put me to shame.
Yeah, we sit in an office all day.
I would say it's about 38.
Yeah, okay, wow.
Yeah.
So that shows what you need to do to be at the top level of speed.
Well, to get your resting heart rate down to 38, like it's some pretty serious training.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And are the other riders on the same level as you in terms of fitness?
It's not really public with the right thing. So you might see a lot of riders that have like a natural body type of being skinny.
Okay.
But that isn't me. Like I've always struggled with my weight. So for me to be at 66.7 kilos now, it's the lightest I've ever been before a season. I'm the fittest I've ever been before a season. My results on a DEXA scan are the best they've ever been. My resting heart rate's the best it's ever been. VO2 max is the best it's ever been. So when I say I'm ready to win the world title this year, like I'm 100% ready. I'm like levels above what I've ever been. So I'm like really looking forward to this year.
Can I just ask about the racing your friend's sprint car in Oz? Did you find the transition complete? I mean, what you do gives you a fantastic, I mean, you must have fantastic natural balance to be able to do what you do. And
yeah, it's even easier when I got four wheels.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, did it seem quite easy? Did it feel like a very comfortable switch?
Yeah, everything translated. So it was like everything that I'd do on a speedway bike, as far as the track craft, you know, going into the corner here, like passing people, doing a cutback and going up the inside of them and chopping away from them and like chopping the nose off as I run up to the fence. All that sort of stuff was the same. The only thing that took me a couple of laps to get used to is the wing. So like normally, like say if this is your track here, oh hang on, I'm gonna, oh, which way? Yeah, say if that's your track there, normally I'd like turn here on a speedway bike and I'd drift into the corner and like go up to mid track, but because we're drifting so far, you turn a little bit earlier. But with the car, you come down the straight and you aim for the fence and you wait till you're about 3 meters before the fence and then you just turn. So you're like driving this car flat out, like you've got over 600 horsepower and you flat out straight for this wall and you think like it's hard to tell your brain to keep going straight and aim for that wall, because if it didn't turn, obviously you're gonna have the hugest crash ever. And then you get to like 2 meters away from the fence and you just give it a little flick of the steering wheel and the front wing grabs and then the top one grabs and it just rails around the fence and it's like the most unbelievable feeling. But the first time I went out on practice, I like came down the straight, turned and put the car on the center green, because I turned where I'd turn a speedway bike and the wing took over and like pushed it to the center green. So that was pretty funny when I did that. But as far as everything else, it translated. I finished second anyway. And I don't want to be that guy to say it, but if I had one more lap, I would have won. Like it was so frustrating. And then like, I'm telling people, man, if I had one more lap, and they're like, oh, you're that guy. And I'm like, no, I'm legit. Like if I had one more lap, I would have won my first like sprint car event that I'd raced in. So yeah, it was a good evening.
I realise your schedule's kind of pretty busy with all the stuff you're doing on a bike, but I mean, would you fancy having a go at cars again in the longer term if time's available?
Oh, 100%. Like, I'm the kind of person that when I want something, I'll just go get it. So it's really hard for my like wife to buy me presents. And I said, all I want to do is I want to go in a rally car. So it doesn't have to be a sprint car. The rule is with age becomes a cage. So I'm sure that if I get the opportunity, I'll be able to transition over. But yeah, I'm so set on doing a rally because like she sees how I drive our car, like we've got a Mercedes like that we drive around on a day-to-day basis, and she sees how I drive that through the back lanes when it's dark. So yeah, she's like, man, you need to go on a track. And I was like, yeah, that's like what you can sort me. But she's obviously, because I've grown up riding bikes and my limits are so different to anyone else's, like to not just on a personal point of view. So like when I come to like, if you go on holiday and you get to go on a quad or something, like they go really slow, you have to ride in single file, you can't like do jumps, there's all these different like things. So I said like, I want to go on a rally car or a rally cross car, and I don't want anyone sat there telling me I can and can't do something. I just want to go, and that's the hardest part, because she could probably fix me a rally day, but I'm going to have someone in the seat going, yeah, you need to slow down, like you can only like, I just want to go and let rip.
It feels like rallycross is your
rallycross, 600 odd brake horsepower, no co-driver nagging
you. I'm not just saying that because of your hat. It's genuinely a thing that you can.
No problem with plugging Monster. Yeah, Monster's the main plug.
Yeah, we all drink that here. No, but I mean, back to bikes. In terms of riding a motorcycle day to day, do you do that or is it too dangerous?
No. So I've had a few friends like die on road bikes on the road. So I've vouched to never ride on the road. I wouldn't want to put myself on a road bike anyway. Maybe like a Harley or something, Harley Davidson, just to have that like cruise factor. But it's more the fact like the other idiots on the road.
Yeah.
But that's why if I was going to go on the road, I would ride a Harley and not a road bike, because if I rode a road bike, I'd probably kill myself. Like I just have that need for speed. Like I always want to be going fast. So.
And talking to a speedway rider here, I mean, that is incredibly dangerous, surely. I mean, how many injuries have you got through your career?
I've been pretty good, to be fair. I've only like done my tib, fib, both my arms, my hand, my fingers, collarbone 8 times.
Do you get a tattoo for every injury?
No. So they're, but like, I've been lucky, like, they're not big ones, like, they're not like back, like, femur, like, they're the ones that really like mess you up and slow people down. So, yeah.
MotoGP riders, if they fracture an ankle or something, they're normally back on the bike 10 minutes later. I mean, if you have done a tib or a fib, or I mean, how long does it take before you can get back on the bike? Or are you able to ride with a certain degree of injury?
Yeah, depending on which leg it would be. So like if it was your right tib and fib, that's the footrest that you stand on. So you got a lot of pressure through that. So that would be hard. You probably wouldn't be able to ride on the right, but on the left, you don't really use it. So you could probably get away with like, you know, 3 weeks if it was like screwed and plated. Doctors always tell you 6 to 12 weeks. Like that's just to cover their ass so they don't like have any issues in the future. So if a doctor tells you like 6 to 12 weeks, you normally half it. Like that's the rule of
thumb. That's a speedway rule or your rule.
Well, that's probably an athlete rule.
Okay, yeah. I double it.
Like a car racer or a motorcyclist or like, you're normally half what they say. So I broke my collarbone in 2013 and raced the next round of the World Championships 2 weeks later. So it's...
Just with painkillers?
Nah, because we're on WADA anti-doping, so you can only really take paracetamol, and broken collarbone, so paracetamol don't really do anything.
So you just have to grin and bear it?
Yeah, just man up a little bit. And then I broke it again the second last round. I crashed again and broke it again in my first race, and I continued racing that night.
Wow. I mean, yeah. And in terms of Poland being a huge scene for this, do you see a big difference between the different kind of stadia that you race at? Or is there a big surface difference, and then do you have to calculate for that? Or is it pretty simple? Okay.
Nah, yeah. So like we've tried data logging, but data logging is really hard because we haven't got like tarmac, hot, cold, or wet and dry.
Right.
We have like different material in Poland, different in Sweden, different in England, different in the Grand Prix, indoor world championship rounds, they bring in a different dirt which has more stones in it. You go to Slovenia, it's really stony and sandy and not much like clay or shale. So the tracks do change everywhere you go, even in Poland, like from one Sunday to the next is different. And then depending on how much sun there is as to how dry it gets, if they water it, if it's got stones and they drag it from the outside to the inside, then it's like riding on marbles. So the track's evolving every 5 minutes, every 2 minutes. So you constantly see a rider do the race, come back to the, look over the fence, watch the track grade, are they watering? And you're trying to set the bike up based on what you're seeing from over the fence.
What's the most challenging kind of scenario that you've ever raced in? And do you remember a particular race where you really struggled with the surface?
Yeah, so last year in Slovenia, it was my worst, score in my career, ever. Like even in league racing, I got 5 points. My worst score was 8, leading up to that event. And I got 5, and just a track that I can't figure out. I can be fast everywhere all year, and then I'll go there and struggle to make the semi-final. Don't know why. We try different setups every time over the last however many years we've been for pre-season testing at that track to try and find something that works. Then the pre-season test, you feel like you've got a good setup, and then you run it in the Grand Prix and it's like, wow, that's like we're miles off still. So that track's always, there's always something there. But in 2015 I was really fast there. Like I was passing people for fun. I was going from last to first, couldn't get out the start, but yeah, last to first and passing people like they were stood still. So
in the car world, drivers often talk about a favorite track, whether it's Spa or Cadwell Park, wherever it might be. I mean, your world, all the tracks are essentially the same shape, give or take surface differences. I mean, do you actually have a favorite?
Yes.
One where you always feel completely
hooked
up? There's
different cambers, different banking, different shapes, narrower straights, wider straights. So they do all feel completely different to ride, even though they are all still an oval, which is nice, because then you're not having that repetitive kind of feeling like you're doing the same thing all the time. But as far as an event's concerned, the British Grand Prix, in Warsaw they have 60,000, it's sold out. But in Cardiff they might have 45,000, 50,000. Stadium's not sold out, but the atmosphere's twice as good. So if I was going to recommend anyone to come watch an event, I'd say go to that one. It's a man-made track, indoor, good atmosphere, loud, good buzz around the city because it's all quite close and tied in together at the Principality Stadium. So the whole event just has that aura and that buzz about it, and it's just a great one to be involved with.
Is there ever a place where you encounter fans that are like football ultras? I mean, do people really get into speedway in the same way, you know, flares and chants and all that?
Yeah, in Poland they do. Yeah. I've seen there's one track in Sweden that does it, but in Poland it's like every track, like they have like police around the away fans, and they always video the away fans at every race we go to. You know, they're shaking the fence and screaming at each other and throwing cans and drinks, and gets a bit out of hand. But it all adds to the atmosphere, and normally they don't sit the hooligans, is what they call them, together. They're kind of like on the opposite side of the stadium from each other, but they sing to each other. And
I mean, this is amazing.
Are you conscious of that when you're actually racing?
Yeah, can't not be. They're so loud. Like when you've got like, I don't know, there's probably like five to 10,000 of them squashed into that area, and they're all singing the same song. Sometimes if like there's a stadium, at our stadium the roof kind of goes over, so what they do, they all walk up to the stairs and they face the stadium, they face the grandstand, and they sing into the grandstand so the echoes and comes out louder.
Like, it's just atmosphere nuts. Must be incredible.
Yeah, it's cool.
Ty, it's been a real pleasure and a privilege to have you here this morning. Thank you ever so much for joining us, but we are now out of time. So I'll say thank you all to tuning in to this latest Royal Automobile Club podcast in association with Motorsport Magazine, and we look forward to seeing you again next time. Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.